I must be honest with you. I've had a hell of a day. I watched the most recent two Mission Impossible films today before England played football in the European Championships. That's when we're recording this. So it's been a lot of TV time for me, a stressful TV time. And, you know, we decided to do this, I would say, about 6 weeks ago.
We.
I suggested that we do this about 6 weeks ago, and I got on a great run, Adam, and I watched 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in about 2 weeks, and I thought, oh, this is good. You know, I mean, I'm sort of getting it. I'm feeling the vibe. I'm absorbing Cruise and a la gang. But what I don't want to do, I thought to myself, is I don't want to watch them all and then 4 weeks later record a podcast about them, because I'll have forgotten everything, you know, leaky bucket brain and all. So I thought, I'll put it off. And then when I put it off, I just got into putting it off until today, when we're going to record it in the evening, and I still have two really, really, really long films left to watch on a timer. So the reason I'm saying that is because it might have hampered ever so slightly my enjoyment of the... You texted me earlier and you said you're hardly watching them in the correct circumstances, and I thought that's a fair point. And that's a nice caveat, a disclaimer from me ahead of what promises to be a very exciting episode.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host, and Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast. With me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever is the old aforementioned leaky bucket boy brain, Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello there. You all right?
Thanks, everyone, for listening. For anyone who's listened to the Pick One series of episodes that have just gone out.
Pick One.
Apologies if they seemed a bit self-indulgent. They seemed like a good idea at the time.
What, have you got in your own head? Why are you saying that?
I mean, I'm just worried that it was just us listing films and we're like film bores.
So?
No, it's fine.
What's wrong with that? Have you gone cold on them since you said the last one had low energy? You've gone cold on them, haven't you? Have you lost confidence?
We got one more special, and you'll know what it is because we've labelled it. It's the Mission Impossible episode.
And I tell you what, watching 7 movies for one podcast was mission bloody impossible, wasn't it? Except we did it, just like Tom Cruise does in every one of those films.
Yeah, your mission, if you choose to accept it, was to watch 7 Mission Impossible movies. I broadly love this series. Joe was making fun of me. And here we are.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to do. Joe's going to come at me. And I'm going to try and...
I don't know why you think
bat him away.
I've been trying to reassure Adam over the last few weeks that I won't be coming at him. Every time I text you something, I say, oh, I'm interested, I think we should talk about this, I always make sure to caveat it with, this doesn't mean I hate it or you, and this doesn't mean I'm going to attack it. I'm just curious to have an open conversation about it. I'm not going to attack these films. I got thoughts about them that I'm hoping you'll be interested in. But, you know... Broadly, enjoyed watching them, mostly.
Okay, well, don't spill your beans. Remember, I made you wait till the end of the Gladiator episode
to let you
know if I liked it.
Well, that's because I can't be countenanced, you know. That's
you've taken all the tension out of a Mission Impossible podcast.
No, I've blown you up a little bit. I've popped a little bit of air in there, helium. And over the course of the podcast, I'm just going to poke that balloon with a few pins. That's all.
Mission Impossible 1 comes out in 1996. We're nearly 30 years ago, for God's sake. And if I read the letterboxed for the first one, I feel like that's basically the letterboxed for all of them.
Okay.
So here's the letterboxed for the Brian De Palma directed first. Expect the impossible. When Ethan Hunt, Timothy Cruz, the leader of a crack espionage team whose perilous operation has gone awry with no explanation, discovers that a mole has penetrated the CIA, he's surprised to learn that he's the number one suspect. To clear his name, Hunt must now ferret out the real double agent, and in the process, even the score. Now,
yeah,
you know, elements of that pretty much happen in every...
can I say that I love it? He could only have been surprised that he was the one, he was the mole, they thought, in the first film, because by the fifth or sixth film, you assume that a scene will go, no, Ethan, they think you, and he stops them. Yes, they think I'm the mole, I know. That's how it works in every film. Don't worry about it, it's fine, it's fine.
I saw this at the cinema when I was 15 years old.
Did you?
And... you know, I'm locked in. I used to watch the TV series, the original 1960s TV series on Channel 4, off and on. And this was it. This was, I loved this when it came out. I remember watching it and the dialogue, they say keywords quite low in the mix. And the word mole is never really enunciated properly. I didn't really fully understand the plot of the first one. There's a bit where he kind of mutters, this whole thing was a mole hunt. This whole thing was a mole hunt. And you're like, what? It was a what hunt? What's a mole?
A man hunt.
A mud hunt. A what? But that's what I liked about this. It was action. It was espionage. And, you know, it was lots of... lots of fun.
Well, I can't imagine watching this at 15 years old because I'm 33, and one of the notes I wrote down from for the first film is the scene where John Voight comes back from the dead and is explaining stuff, but Cruise is seeing something else. I had no clue what was going on come the end of that film. That is, it's a weird movie, and it also is the foundational point for the thing I found most interesting about watching the whole series, which I'm sure we'll come back to throughout this episode, is just how the tone changes. Because film one is wild. It's sort of sleazy. He's kind of, you know, you see this in the second film as well. He's kind of unforgivably sexy, you know. And I think also it's worth, as we go through the films, just taking a quick look there at how the female characters are written, how that evolves over time, because it's pretty bad early on, isn't it?
It's not bad early on in number one. It's really bad in number two. What I'm more interested in is the evolution of the Ethan Hunt character and how they find who he is over the films.
Yeah.
And in the first one, he's this kind of angry, he's very angry in that first movie. And then in the second one, the shit one, he's this horribly sleazy, sexy, goofy, like, kind of character.
He's a smug dickhead.
And then it's three, the best one, directed by J.J. Abrams, where the Ethan Hunt that I've come to love
emerges.
You really, right. Yeah, the kind of, he's a Boy Scout. He's got a very key core... center.
He loves his friends.
Exactly.
He's basically non-sexual also come that point, right? He's a little sexy in the first film. He's very sexy in the second film. And then, like, come the later films, you imagine that he doesn't ever have sexual relations.
But then I think that's Cruise recognizing that he's no longer a sex symbol.
Sure. Well, would you say it's fair to characterize that first film and maybe the second one as... Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise as the star, at least some of the producers might have thought, oh, this could be America's answer to James Bond, because it feels more in the vein of those kind of pre-Daniel Craig, the pre-Pierce Brosnan, the sort of weirder, sillier, earlier Bonds, doesn't it?
No.
Okay.
I don't agree, because it's based on an existing American TV show, Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Which obviously existed in a Ian Fleming Bond world, and maybe was even created out of that.
Yeah.
It feels so different to Bond, to my mind. I know Bond very well, but these just because you've got a spy, a super spy, they don't match up at all. Bond is big and stupid. And the mission movies are kind of quite, the second one accepted. They are more about like tricks and cons and a lot of mask play, and it's almost like an oceans mask type vibe.
Mask play.
Which Bond movies do you think that Mission One is anywhere like connected to? Maybe the Daltons?
Maybe
the Daltons, but like who's copying, who'd want to copy the Dalton Bond?
Well, I don't know, but I think just more broadly, the Tom Cruise, the Ethan Hunt character is broadly similar to the pre-Daniel Craig James Bond. He is a super spy, as you say. He's a sexy guy that ladies love, and you know he basically wants to have sex with everyone in the first three movies.
No,
okay, that's fine.
Wrong.
He doesn't. What's wrong about that?
In the first one, he doesn't. It's all about him denying wanting to have sex with his best friend's wife.
I mean, he hardly denies it. Like, he definitely wants to have sex with his best friend's wife, and even more he wants to after his friend is dead, right?
Yeah, but he struggles with it. Bond never struggles with that. Bond uses sex to... He always has sex with the evil baddie's woman, and he uses it to open doors. Ethan Hunt never uses... Wait a minute. Ethan Hunt never uses sex as a spy weapon,
okay.
Ever.
When I said that some producer might have thought this could be our answer to the Bond movies, I didn't mean like they would be exactly the same. That they would be the American version of that. So in the ways that you've pointed out that they are different, that's the difference, isn't it? Those are the differences. But just in terms of like a big action movie franchise with one guy whose name isn't in the title, but, you know, is like, you know, Ethan Hunt is basically a James Bond for America. But I don't think that's wrong to say.
Look, Joe, I'm being really defensive. the Bond series are a shit series of films. You're obviously not wrong. The producers probably thought, can we have an American Bond? And can we get Cruise to be in a series of spy films with a mixture of action and spying, and we'll get different directors to do each one, and they'll have a different flavour.
In a brushstroke sense.
It's extremely thick of me to just say no to that.
No, but it's interesting what you were saying about how they're different.
So, yes, you're right, but also I went back to read the review of the first mission and the second mission, and the reviews mention like old Bond, and I don't see any like the specifics within the film, what happens and how the stories are told. Like for number one, certainly it's not Bond. It's nothing like Bond. And I think Bond's a shit. Bond's a shit.
Maybe the second one is probably the later ones.
Mission 2 is definitely Bond.
Yeah. You're right that they're a bit more espionage-y, though. I think that's true. And that some of that stuff is quite fun. What do you think the key differences between like a spy, espionage spy movie and then like an action hero movie are? And how does one fall into one bucket or the other, you know? Like what's the key differences here that keep Mission Impossible in the sort of espionage-y character file?
That's a great question. I think...
Masks.
It does come down to masks. Invariably, there is a MacGuffin that they have to... Not invariably. Every time there's a MacGuffin, there's a thing that they need... Someone's after a thing.
Yeah. A key is the most recent one for me.
And they need to stop the person getting a key, tricking them into thinking they got the key, but they didn't get the key.
Yeah.
Or it's tricking someone else into thinking something and then getting a bit of information.
Or it's tricking me into thinking that they're being tricked when actually they're the ones doing the tricking. Like Alec Baldwin.
Exactly.
I knew. Are you proud of me? I knew that's what was happening in that scene. I just knew it because I just watched five other Mission Impossible films. And I went, no, you don't, Mission Impossible 6. You can't pull the fucking wool over my eyes.
Yeah, no, that's you've pegged it. You've Simon pegged it there.
Where the cup that holds the blood of Jesus Christ resides forever.
The Holy Grail, Dr. Jones. The chalice used by Christ during the Last Supper. The cup that caught his blood at the crucifixion. Was entrusted to Joseph of Arimathea.
The Arthur legend.
I've
heard this bedtime story before.
Eternal life.
He has to do a Mission Impossible.
Yeah, he does. And let me say, the set pieces and the stunts, as the movies go on, I go, yeah, all right, go on then. That's very ambitious, and I like that you've thought of it. A whole group of people sat around going, what if he was hanging on the outside of a plane? What if he was under the water, had to dive in through a thing, or sneaking into the Kremlin with the camera thing and all the... You know, it is really good fun, that stuff. I like it a lot. And he... So in as far as it goes with him being a sort of superhero type character, I prefer him as a character in the later films. I prefer him to Bond. And I also... The biggest compliment that I'll pay these films, jumping about a bit now... you already mentioned that after the third film, or you know, sort of starting in the third film, moving onwards, they discover what the Ethan Hunt character is. He's a Boy Scout. I call him a Cub Scout. He's a Boy Scout, and he loves his friends, and he's like much more sort of sexual neutral, you know. And Simon Pegg shows up in these films, and the first time I saw Simon Pegg, I was like, you know, I know what to expect here. No, I don't. The chemistry between Cruise and Pegg, Adam, is actually legitimately good. And the only thing in terms of the comparison between this and Bond movies, you can have a funny comedy sidekick in a Bond film, or you can have a sidekick that brings a little bit of lightheartedness to it, but Daniel Craig is just Daniel Craig. He's James Bond, whatever happens, right? Ethan Hunt is funny. Tom Cruise is funny in these films. It's not just that Simon Pegg is there to zing some one-liners around and about the serious action. He brings out of Cruise this really like fun, adorable character at times within these films. So I can totally see why they've kept him as a key part of the team. It really works, and I believe it. I like it.
Yeah, and then there's also Ving Rhames, and then...
Is that Luther?
Yeah, and then from 5, Rogue Nation, they brought on Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah.
I think he has a really nice relationship with her. After the first one, they kind of realised that Mission Impossible, the TV series, it was all about the team.
Mm.
And that's where, from number 3, you kind of start to get... They start to really work in these kind of mainstay... team characters who'll be in it for the long haul, although not many from number 3 stay. But yeah, it's from number 4 you get Peg knocking around from 3 onwards, and then Ving Rhames, who was in the first, he starts coming back more and more. And then from 4 you get Jeremy Renner, he stays in 2.
Yeah.
He's in Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation.
Henry Cavill for one, even though he plays a more sort of opaque character, he's good fun as a character for Cruise to play off of.
Yeah, and so he's just a bit more, it's a bit more generous than a Bond film.
In America, we do it with a team.
Well, he puts his team and individuals above the mission.
Yeah.
Like if it means killing or sacrificing one person to get the mission done, he won't do it.
Sure.
Because that would mean, that would be a higher ethical failure, that would mean worse things to come.
In that sense, he's really... actually a terrible secret agent, isn't he? Because yeah, that it seems like one of the foregone conclusion, that people on your team will die.
But that's what makes him a special non-Bond, apolitical kind of hero. That's why it's such a great fantasy of it. You want that guy... as the secret super spy doing this, who actually has a backbone.
Can we talk about why you discount number 2? Because that feels important. You've mentioned it a couple of times already. You prefaced this episode in previous episodes by saying you won't be watching number 2 and you won't talk about it, because that's not... Well, not that you won't talk about it, but you won't consider it as part of the series. Let me throw one quote at you. You've already said this one to me once before, but I wonder if this is part of the reason why. Because in the second film, obviously, Tandy Newton plays, I think it's fair to describe her character as a love interest of Tom Cruise. And amongst many confusing things, like where he chases her in a car and then has sex with her and then sends her back into a situation of domestic abuse on his behalf in order to complete the mission. Very the antithesis of what you just described the Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt character as doing. Here's one quote from the film when Tom Cruise is talking to Anthony Hopkins, and he's saying, "How can we put Tandy Newton in this dangerous situation? She won't be able to manage it." Anthony Hopkins' line is, "To go to bed with a man and to lie to him? She's a woman. She's got all the training she needs." And I went, "Oh no."
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, no.
It's a horrible film.
Yeah.
It was shit when it came out. I loved John Woo. He's the director, Hong Kong action director. And so you're thinking, okay, great. He knows action. He'll make a great action flick. But I don't think a Mission Impossible film's strength necessarily are the action. It's the, it, without the relationships and the fun espionage, it's just a shit action film. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's horrible. It's gross. Cruise is playing Ethan Hunt like this sexy goofball. Thandi Newton is used appallingly. It's cheesy. It's gross. It goes full mad John Woo in the last 30 minutes with the action, and it kind of comes out of the blue. And you can't enjoy it. It's not good.
Well, it's got like the most obscene ending of any film I've ever seen, I think. It's my least favourite bit about the entire franchise, because the ending of two, you know, Ethan Hunt's victorious, he's won the day, whatever, and it's set in like the most absurd, idyllic American scene. Where he, you know, he sees her through a crowd. She's wearing jeans and she's got her midriff exposed. He's surrounded by children with all families, and there's colours and balloons everywhere and kites, and it's sunny and they're all on the grass by the water, and there's a big American bridge in the background, and it's like, oh, look at this feat of American engineering. And I felt like I wanted to be sick in my mouth. It was like it had ticked every single cliche box in the world. And also, it's, you know, I don't know, it's interesting that like that's the one that comes just before three, where it feels like there's a big tone change and for the better.
It's good that it exists, because without that they don't take a long hard look at themselves and say, come on, let's pull our pants up and take this series seriously.
Well,
and they get on JJ, they get the best villain ever, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
And it all clicks.
Well, there's a fairly sizable gap between two and three, isn't there? It's like 6 years.
What's Cruise make between Mission Impossible 2 and Mission Impossible 3? Oh, let me guess. Does he... Vanilla Sky?
Vanilla Sky is the film he makes immediately after Mission Impossible 2, MI2. In 2001, Vanilla Sky. Next up, a favourite of yours...
Oh, Minority Report.
It is Minority Report. That's
I'm not
true.
Looking. I knew it was early 2000s, and I know it's one of my favourites.
I'll throw you the next one, because you won't ever get it. A small part, of course, in Austin Powers' Gold Member. then there are three more films before he returns to make MI3 in 2006. One is 2003, 2004, 2005. They're all big movies. They're all movies that you will definitely have seen. They're in fact, I think with the exception of one, they're all films we've talked about before. And they're kind of, they're peak Cruise movies as far as I'm concerned.
Is one the Japanese samurai one?
The Last Samurai in 2003. That's the first of our three, Adam. You're right.
Never seen it.
Have you not?
No.
Oh, you should watch it.
Every time we have this chat, okay, fine.
Should watch it. It tonally speaking, it's a very interesting, like, a middle ground between MI2 and MI3. You know, Cruise is definitely taking himself a bit more seriously in these movies. There's a two-hander next in 2004, kind of a smaller scope film, but really fun, and one where Tom Cruise probably looks as old as he does in Mission Impossible 7.
Is it Night and Day?
It's not Night and Day. That's later in 2010.
That's much later.
It's damage of a special kind. Damage that perhaps wasn't intended, but, you know, it's just part of the core damage.
Collateral.
It's Collateral, yeah. There you go. I quite like that film.
That's a really lovely clue. You should go into the crossword game.
There you go. Damage that wasn't intended. Collateral, I feel like it could feature as a Forgot You Forgot as well, because I quite enjoyed that film. I saw that a couple of times, and it's definitely not discussed as part of the canon.
It's not. I'd eat your hand off. I'd eat your hand off if we could do Collateral.
Okay, well let's put it on our lists for later in the year. And then the next one, based on, of course, the most famous radio broadcast of all time.
So he's doing two Spielbergs.
Yeah. How about it? I mean, so that's interesting. And then we hit MI3, Mission Impossible 3.
What? Come on, what a run of flicks.
Hey.
To bounce back.
Austin Powers from, gold member, a terrific run of flicks.
From MI2, a right royal stinker, with, you know, a fucking Minority Report. Sure. Last Samurai, never seen, but very well regarded. War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And Collateral.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying, before Mission Impossible 2, without that dud, before that he was an Eyes Wide Shut and Magnolia between 1 and 2. So I feel like if John Woo hadn't fucked it so hard in MI2, and the whole gang, not just John Woo's fault, of course, that's just a terrific run for 10 years. But no.
And yet the door to Cruise is always closed.
That's true. it stays closed after MI3 when he plays the guy in the fat suit in Tropic Thunder, you know. But here's the thing about 3, okay? Now, you know I'm going to say this, and don't joke about this, but you know I'm going to say it. 3 comes after something, doesn't it? The 2 came before. And I know, even if that hadn't happened, I know they probably would have changed the tone anyway to come with more of the modern times, but there's no way on earth you're going to tell me that the tonal shift between 2 and 3 does not reflect what happened between the two of them, Adam. Because as far as I'm concerned, the main interesting thing about Mission Impossible, the series, the main interesting thing is how the tone evolves over time and how the films and the characters and the surroundings and the environments reflect the America of the time. Okay, that's what I find interesting about it. Whether it intends it or not, I think it's there. And that's what I'm getting out of it. And 3...
Tell everyone, because I mean, I've just been laughing. Like, you know, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're going to say.
Of course, you know. I think everyone knows.
It's your favorite historical event.
It's not my favorite historical event.
You love to bring in.
No, like, I'm interested in how culture has changed was changed, but you know, before and after.
Before and after what?
9/11. Of course, I'm talking about 9/11. Now, these films, they're dealing with American intelligence, American espionage, America's standing on the world stage. Ethan Hunt is a sort of cipher for that. And I think it's more, you know, it's kind of interesting more broadly. It doesn't have...
Can I ask a question?
Oh, please do.
So you're suggesting that he's a cipher for American intelligence. Do you think we watch Bond movies and see James Bond as a cipher for British intelligence? Or are we watching that? Everyone watching that knows that this is a pure fantasy.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I think there's an important distinction to be made. I think the values and the vibe that the characters, both of them, Bond and Hunt, give off, that's the cipher for the intelligence. What they are, the fictional character, how they do their business, I don't think that's obviously a fiction. And I don't think anybody's watching these films thinking, oh, this is exactly what's happening. Oh, Monday night, someone's, you know, there's a bit of someone's chasing over a crane. I'm not talking about that. But I'm saying some of the lines of dialogue, some of the things they say, the values that the characters hold, or at least that the films espouse, I think those things are cipheric. They're cipherial for these intelligence agencies. And in that sense, I think Bond very much does. He doesn't reflect the Britain of today, because everyone knows the Britain of today is a big, stinking, massive joke on the world stage and doesn't have anything. But Bond as a character, you know, before we moved into a truly post-colonial age where the people of Britain stopped thinking that Britain was like some incredible country that deserved to have its own empire, that our Bond, early Bond, very much did reflect some of those values. And I think whether that's written in intentionally by the writers or not, or it's played in intentionally and performed by the actors or not, it just is there, because the setting of the world that they that these films are made in is as much as possible a kind of up-to-date setting, in the same way that the technology updates and the enemies update, and you know, they reflect the world around them. And I think this does happen with Mission Impossible, with all the films. I'm not picking on it specifically, with all these sorts of films, however different they are from each other.
Yeah, maybe the values, like Bond, his values represent how England wants to see itself.
Yes.
But it doesn't reflect our actual intelligence capacity. And In the same way, I don't think anyone's watching the Mission Impossible movies like in the geopolitical sense, they never tally up with really what's going on in the actual world. And your problem, my only pushback is that once Hunt is the character is really formed in three, his values really stay the same, and he stays quite consistent as a character. So whilst America changes around him, he kind of stayed from three right up to number seven. He stays quite consistent, even though the world around him has changed. So how do you tally that with your theory about him changing with time?
Well, there's two distinct eras in this series of films. One of them is before 9/11 and the other is after. So the character after 9/11, I think, would be more consistent. And I think you made an excellent point, though, and that's a really good distinction. What I'm not saying is that they reflect the actual values. I think they reflect the values that either, you know, the American, if you're sticking with the Mission Impossible films now, that either the American intelligence agencies would want the American public to have, or the type of feeling that the American public would deep down like to have about their intelligence agencies, because the vast majority of the American public are very skeptical of intelligence agencies, as you can see reflected in these films as well. That's very clear, right?
Yeah, these films are very cynical about the real, like the CIA,
sure,
invariably, is a kind of a baddie, and it's the Impossible Mission Force,
right?
The fictional thing.
There you go.
The fictional group that are overseeing and or like out on their own, and they're the good guys.
Yeah.
And
isn't that a funny contortion?
It's this wish. The wish fulfillment of it is if only these people, if only goodness prevailed,
right?
And we had the right people in these kinds of jobs.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And I don't mind that. That's what stories are for.
No, fine. That's fine.
Some people would say these movies are they're made to as propaganda to put people to sleep and to say, no, this is intelligence is a force for good, and secret government agents are, you know, the way forward. And I think that's a really thick, thick reading.
That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying,
I know you're not.
Yeah, I think you've already hit the nail on the head, right? And it's beautiful because you're making my point for me, and I absolutely adore it when you do that. The main value that these films espouse is, or are the values of individualism, right? You put it perfectly already. The American public are skeptical about American intelligence agencies. And so in their wish fulfillment movie version of events, what's their answer to all of these, corrupt individuals within these American intelligence agencies? Well, their answer is to have another, more secret, more better, more good intelligence agency that does even more rogue of its own accord. Like the individual hero wins it over again against the horrible vision of the big government, where like all of these bad guys, they're all slipping through the cracks of a bureaucracy, aren't they? They're like part of the system. They're on the payroll. HR's missed that when they hired them, they worked in a Soviet submarine for 6 years, and it's because of big government that like they've missed that out. Because if they had a small, nimble team of purebred Americans that were in like the International Monetary Fund, and they could go around the world and just, they would do a better job. What if we had that? but it was even better. That's our answer to it. And here's a, like, I wrote a couple of quotes from the from movie number six. So I know we're jumping around a bit, but movie number six, which is, what's that one called? Ghost Nation, is it?
Number six is Fallout.
Fallout. Yeah, you're right. Fallout.
It's, they all get, from three onwards, they all start having silly names. You've got four is Ghost Protocol, then Rogue Nation,
Fallout,
Dead Reckoning,
Part One. I wonder what the next one will be called. Now
it's not going to be called Dead. They decided to abandon Dead Reckoning. Yeah, it's really, it's just really, really shoddy and embarrassing. They spent $300 million on a part two, and they're going to go, and we've called it something else.
I love that. That's, I actually really like that. It makes me like it more. Here's a couple of quotes from Fallout number six. Yeah. Deep down, they both knew someday something terrible was going to happen. Yeah. That's lovely. It's not about the American people. It's about Cruise and his wife. But it's in the middle of a film where Cruise has to, he has to be on top of it, because constantly there's like an absolutely enormous mega threat to the world and to America's values, and therefore you know, he's sort of traumatically waiting for something bad to happen, like it happened before. Yeah, that's the mindset of the post 9/11 action movie. And the second quote, his wife says to him at the end of Fallout, she said, nothing happened here because you were here. And I sleep soundly at night knowing that you will always be here. Yeah? Yeah. Even when she doesn't know that he's there, even when she doesn't know that what he's doing, she has blind, pure faith in him because he is an American intelligence agency. And no, that's what that is. That's what that is.
No, it's because he's Ethan Hunt. It's not. If you just read that line, it's like, oh, thank you, big brother, for watching over me. That's his wife, his ex-wife from number three.
Sure. Yeah.
The amount he sacrificed, mm-hmm. you know, he puts his team in front of, he is an individualist kind of operation, but at the same time, it baked in is, it's a little community of
individuals
where they all care about each other more than a country or a nation.
If only the politics. CIA had love and friends.
Yeah, the most important thing is each other, and they're doing it for each other, and as a result it's fine and it's apolitical.
I'm not saying it's political. I definitely don't think it, like, I certainly don't mean it's party political or anything like that. I think it's impossible for a film like this not to be political in a very macro sense. I think I would completely dispute that is the case, but I know what you mean, like in a very kind of, you know, day-to-day American way. It's not, certainly not party political.
Well, it's political in the way that it like most American movies are where you've got a hero. It's like, we just need a bloody hero who can go in and sort this bloody mess out.
Sure.
Let's get, like, stop all the pen pushing and stop all this bloody, these horrible bureaucrats and these horrible liars and these baddies. And if we had John Wayne, if we had Clint Eastwood, if we had Tom Cruise, if we had Liam Neeson, you know, killing the people who needed to be killed. And they know, they know who needs to be killed.
Yeah, because they have a perfect moral compass of who should be killed and who shouldn't be killed because they're American.
Yeah, well, they're Batman. You know, this is Batman and...
Batman doesn't kill, but, you know.
He ends up people dying around him a lot.
People die around him, but famously doesn't kill, does he? Famously just beats them up and then, like, ties them up and stuff. It's a whole thing. Can't even kill Joker, who definitely should be killed.
Okay, yeah, you know, yeah, fuck it. He still acts like he knows who's bad.
Sure.
And who needs beating up. He still batters the fuck out of people.
He knows who's Bat. He's Bat. And he's the only one that's Bat. Until Batgirl shows up.
Cruise is more like Superman, who even more doesn't want to kill anyone.
Yeah.
And is even more like, he'll put other people over his own personal needs and would sacrifice that.
You don't think Batman does that? I think Batman does that. I know you didn't mean, when you started this, I know you weren't trying to get into a thing about who's like more self-effacing and selfless. Is it Batman or Ethan Hunt? But I think it might be Batman.
No, I think Batman, he's always banging on about his dead parents. He's so angry and like, oh, my parents are dead. Oh, my parents are dead. He's got, whereas Hunt isn't got that that anger.
Well, his parents aren't dead. You find that out in one of the movies.
And you find out he's a kind of a farm boy. He's an all-American farm boy, just like Superman.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah. So
he actually kills people, just like Superman. You know? He flies around the world really fast in order to reverse time so that he didn't make Mission Impossible 2.
Just like Superman.
Yeah. Whoa. Hey, here's something I really liked. I wrote this down, Adam, because it meant something to me. Yeah. I wrote down this. Everyone needs someone to believe in them the way that Luther believes in Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, who says that?
I say that. I wrote it down.
Oh, okay. I thought that was a character. That's a really on-the-nose line of dialogue. Like, does Peg say that?
No, I say that. Because I think it's really nice. That's what I like about the team, yeah? You get to the end of these later films when they're trying to do something. I mean, it's the Mission's Impossible. I don't know if we've said that, but the Mission's Impossible, and there's times where they're like, oh, is Cruise going to do it or not? Or, well, we're scared. We don't know. And Luther goes, hey, shut the fuck up. Cruise is going to do it. Because he's Cruise, yeah? He's just no sweat, no worry. He's always chilled out. He's cool. You know, he's calm and collected. He just trusts Hunt. And I watched that and I think, God, if there was a person in my life that believed in me like that, I'd be a megalomaniac, you know?
Well, it's interesting because Luther, played by Ving Rhames, is very much the heart of pretty much the whole series.
Yeah.
And I think he originally in the script, he was in the first one, he was going to die.
Yeah.
And Ving Rhames is just like, no, you know, why's the black guy always got to die?
Yeah.
And Cruise is like, yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
Hey man, I never thought about that before. That's a great, let's change the world. Hey, have you ever heard of Scientology?
Ugh, low hanging fruit, mate.
Come on.
And it's Macquarie, who would go on, he's done all of them since Rogue Nation.
Yeah.
He really has identified and lent into that, you know, that character.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way that he's kind of really lent into and brought in Benji Dunn, played by Simon Pegg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you say that there's before 9/11 and there's after 9/11.
Yeah.
I think there's before Christopher McQuarrie and there's after Christopher McQuarrie.
And does he show up from number four?
He came on as a script doctor tinkerer to resolve problems of Ghost Protocol.
Yes.
And he's on from Rogue Nation onwards.
Yeah.
He'd written and directed Jack Reacher with Cruise. They got on like a house on fire, a very solid little picture. And then he's like, I rewatched that with my mother recently.
Really?
Well, I rewatched it. She'd never seen it before.
Right.
And she was asking lots of questions.
Did you watch Jack Reacher Never Go Back?
I did. Really bad.
Yeah.
Really bad. But that's because Macquarie didn't do it.
Didn't take its own title seriously, did it?
It was originally, it was always, the idea was like, we'll always get a different director on. We can get different flavours of Mission.
Mm-hmm.
So then once Macquarie comes on, they've got a guy who just really, really wants, he kind of wants to figure out and really finesse and crack the formula of what a Mission Impossible movie is.
Right.
And from Rogue to Dead Reckoning, that's what you're seeing. And I think sometimes to its detriment, you're seeing slightly overworked, overplotted, overlong films as they progress. Rogue Nation is topping at 2 hours, Fallout 2 hours 20, and Dead Reckoning
it's 2:45.
It's just too much. But I still think they're really, really good, and they're probably he's the best thing that happened to the series.
I think that's probably true. Those last few, though, the last two, there are big chunks of boring. they just are. I mean, you know, and I know I wasn't in the best, you know, frame of mind to watch them today. But there are sizable chunks of like, come on, I know you're going to put a mask on, or just do, you know, go and do the thing. I'm cool with the fun stunts, you know. Yeah, sure. Hold on to the plane. Drive the bike off the thing. I like that. I want to see that. I'm up for this. You know, I like the little bits back and forth. But it's just all the fucking stuff in the middle, man. I'm like, come on, come on. I get it. Yeah, this is movie 7. I know what's happening. Just go and do a run and jump. You know?
Yeah. I did feel that with the most recent one. Like with the setup, I was like really waiting for it to kick in, but then the finale, the last hour of it, it paid off so much that I kind of forgave everything.
Sure, because there was a fun bit on a train.
It's an amazing bit on the train.
Yeah, do it an hour earlier.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. But
I'm saying, you know, it because I know our listeners would expect you to say that as well. Because it's your favourite thing to say.
They made that film, they shot it through COVID, and they probably were, like, notoriously, they're kind of rewriting or writing it as they go. Like, as he was making it, he didn't even know this baddie is the AI. And he kind of didn't, I've listened to Macquarie talking about this, he didn't really... There's whole chunks of that film that they would have filmed, and he doesn't know whether the baddie is real or in the computer, if right. You know what I mean. Like, yeah, he hasn't decided. I listen to that and I think, fucking hell, that's like, sounds like the antithesis of how you make a good movie. But this is the guy who wrote Macquarie. This is the guy who wrote Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
And he's smart as fuck. And he can do whatever he wants, as far as I'm concerned. Sure. If that's the movie he wants to make, he can make it.
He can make it, and he did make it. But it is very long. It is long. And it's not Lord of the Rings, so he doesn't get a pass.
He shot the best action sequences in all of them, across three films. Like the bike chase in Fallout.
The water scene in Rogue Nation, when they're all underwater, those scenes are good. Diving in to do the thing...
The train bit. Dead Reckoning.
Hanging onto the side of the plane is fun. The running and jumping around London in, I think that's Rogue Nation as well. That's fun. I like that. And I enjoy to see the scene where he broke his ankle, you know. That's fun as well. Oh, Abu Dhabi. Not Abu Dhabi, Dubai. When he's in the climbing up and down the Burj Khalifa, that's scary. That was scary.
Yeah, but that's Brad Bird.
I like that one.
You had it in Mission 2 when he's climbing. The opening sequence is him free climbing, and he's kind of done the stunt for real. They did that with the Burj Khalifa. Like, he's really up there. They really did that. And then slowly, that becomes the selling point for the movies. It's like,
which, you know, he really stunts? Did that, actually. That's Tom Cruise himself, not some puffed up bloody stunt double.
Yeah, and like jumping out the back of a plane in a wanna in Fallout.
Does he ride the motorcycle off the cliff?
He does.
Right.
And so I love practical stunts, but the fact that they, like, that's, they bang on about it so much to this now, like it's a thing. I kind of think, I'll just fucking make the movie and release it.
Yeah. Imagine the insurance would be so expensive, wouldn't it, for Cruise to do his own stunts?
I mean, yeah.
I wonder how much more money it costs to do that than just to get, you know, just to get a stunt double.
Well, he snapped his ankle and they had to stop shooting a film for...
Yeah.
I don't know, 6 months.
Right.
That's tens of millions of dollars.
But it really sold the movie, didn't it? That was the main advertising juice for that film.
No, the main advertising juice for Fallout was, this is a superb film. A little bit long, but it's great. Like, that's the that put him back in Big Town.
Right.
You know,
everyone I know was talking about the ankle.
Yeah, sure, but that's not the reason. You don't go to see the film to go... that's not... People go and see films like that because someone at the office goes, oh, no, actually, it's really good. You should see it. Not, oh, you know, he broke his ankle. That's just gossip.
I don't think that's true. I'm not sure the relationship is as direct, and I think I probably agree with you in terms of saying no one's going to see it specifically because of that. But it adds to the lore. It adds to the mystique about these films. And if you're if you're a viewer uncertain as to whether you're going to go or not, and you hear enough people talk about how incredible it was that Tom Cruise did these things himself, I think it's part of the sell. I really do.
Yeah.
I think if I was round the water cooler and so, if someone said to me, hey, the new Tom Cruise movie is good, I'd spend 10 minutes explaining to them why the door was never open on Tom Cruise. But if someone said... Tom Cruise, he actually broke his ankle. They use that shot in the film. I'd go, oh, he takes it very seriously. Oh, maybe I should check that out. Maybe I'll pay with my own money for a ticket to see that in a local cinema. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
You picking up what I'm putting down?
Yeah. I just don't know those kinds of people, and I would have no respect for them.
I am that person, and you know me. And I think you respect me.
I did.
Before I said that.
But if that's the thing that's tipping you over, whether you see a film or not, I kind of think, I mean, I don't kind of think, I definitely think, where's your backbone?
Well, I don't have one. That's the point, isn't it? Well, I'm just talking about human psychology here. I'm talking about what really moves the needle, yeah? And you well know that one human being saying to another human being, oh, it's quite good, that's enough. Half the human beings they say that to are going to go, well, I'll never watch it. I won't like it. I like good films. You know, that's what people do. That's what people I know do. If you trick them into it by telling the story, the lore of an ankle snapping. Yeah. That's a little earworm, a little brain bug that builds over time and changes your perception of Cruise. I think it's definitely part of the advertising campaign.
What else are you gonna slag it? You know, I'm sick of you slagging off these movies.
Right, yeah. I've done so much of that.
It's absolutely endless.
The villains.
I'm really tired.
The villains, I completely forgot Brendan Gleeson was even in these movies, to be honest.
No, he doesn't count.
He doesn't count as
a villain.
Sean Harris, I just don't think he's a good villain. And I love him as Ian Curtis in the Joy Division bit of 24-Hour Party People. But I don't like him as whatever the fuck his name is in these films. And I think it's a fine experiment to try, but no, bad.
He's barely in Rogue Nation.
Yeah.
And he's really kind of whispering his lines.
He's not frightening.
He's just because he's an odd-looking guy.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense that he wants to be in it.
No.
And he really didn't want to be in Fallout.
No.
But he's a bit better with the beard in Fallout.
Maybe. They tried to just make him a bit like of an ethereal bad guy villain, like above it, almost like preacher. There's like religious overtones. It's just boring. I don't care.
My issue with him is I have no idea who he is or what he wants.
Yeah. Or even what he believes in, despite the fact that they keep talking about it. Ad nauseum, and it's annoying and boring, and shut up, I don't care about the specific philosophy that you're trying to eradicate from the world. Just kill the fucking guy on the train.
Yeah, it's not specific enough. It's just a lot of waffle, and it's just like, what is it? Because you go back to Seymour Hoffman, he's just bad.
Three more Hoffman, yeah?
Maybe it must be all Hoffman who kind of brings that character to life and makes it so rich. Because like on the page, maybe another actor maybe makes it a bit hammy or a bit, we've seen this all before.
Sure. And you feel that a little bit with when you watch Mission Impossible 3, Philip Seymour Hoffman, the lines he reads kind of lame. You know, he's very annoyed all the time and angry and petty and he says stupid things. But the way Philip Seymour Hoffman plays it, it's out of this world, Adam. It's unbelievable. It is, by a country mile, the best thing about the entire Mission Impossible series. For me, he is exceptionally good, and he's frightening and sweaty, and like, I hate him. I'm afraid of when he's going to explode. I believe it. I understand why he does it. And this is all in the middle of like what otherwise, if you replaced him with an actor of the, not of the quality or caliber, because I don't think that's what's necessarily wrong with some of the other villains in the series, but with a similar villain to the others in the Mission Impossible series, number three is fine. Like, it's probably one of the better ones, but it's nowhere near as good as it is. He's unbelievable. What a shame he's dead.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, there's a really great bit where he's playing Cruise, basically. Like, Cruise has got the mask of Hoffman on, but obviously Philip Seymour Hoffman is playing it. It's not Cruise with a mask on.
Yeah.
Hoffman's playing Cruise, playing Hoffman. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
You can see like that. You can really see it. You can see Hoffman's acting as Hunt.
Yeah.
It's lovely. The opening sequence of Mission Impossible 3 is the best sequence of all the movies, and he is the best thing about all of the movies. You're not wrong.
It's just brilliant. It's just brilliant. If you put someone amazing in these films, they'll elevate it, you know?
Yeah, the rest of the films don't really have good villains, never mind Sean Harris.
Yeah.
The baddie in Ghost Protocol is like just a nothing Russian guy.
Yeah, nothing Russian guy.
Dougray Scott in the second is gross.
Yeah.
John Voight is actually okay, but far too old to have such a young French wife. They're just not great villains. No. And I don't think I don't think it's a problem. What were you going to say about the seventh?
Well, I was going to say the guy in Dead Reckoning Part One, the sort of AI, is he real, is he not guy, he's rubbish. He's very, very boring. And also they very quickly get on board, don't they, with, oh, this man's a bad man. You know, the things he wants and says, he's bad. And he's from my past. We've never mentioned him before, but he's actually one of the worst guys I've ever seen. I thought he was dead. And let me tell you, the things he believes and wants, and he's bad. You know, I think, fucking hell. Rebecca Ferguson's character, she says, oh, I've heard about him just from some of my colleagues via email. We can't let the bomb get into this guy's hands. Like, you don't even know him. You know, what does he want? He wants everyone dead. Oh, okay, cool. Well, way to take the stakes to the fucking moon, guys. He wants everyone dead. Great, great. What a fantastic character for me to sink my teeth into, yeah? No reason. There's no reason. He just wants everyone dead. Oh, it is
okay,
that.
Okay, okay. All right, stop it now. I'm starting to... My feelings are getting hurt. There's an interesting fact. Nicholas Hoult was supposed to play that character.
Oh, yeah?
Imagine how much more interesting it would have been with Nicholas Hoult. We could be having Seymour Hoffman chats, but he was busy with some TV show, so we got S.A. Morales instead. But I don't think it's not a nail in the coffin to have, you know, these nothing villains, because for me it's not about the villains,
it's everything else.
It's about the mission and it's about the team and the mechanics and the plot you there. So you know, they're missing a trick that they've had such weak villains, but you know, it's, I don't give a fuck.
Do you want one more quote?
Yeah, man.
Okay, this is from the third movie. And this is Tom Cruise talking about his wife. Yeah. What I see in Julia is life before all of this. And it's good. Yeah? What do you think he's talking about? 9/11. No. you want to play the box office game?
Well, how are you going to play this with me?
Well, I've got...
We're
not doing all seven. But I picked three because I thought... No, not the third film. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I did pick the third film. But I picked three of the films just to see if we could see if it grows or whatever over time. So I picked the first film, the third film, and the most recent film. Not the one that hasn't come out yet, but Dead Reckoning 2. Yeah?
Okay.
Okay, great. Let's begin with Mission Impossible, no colon, because it's just the first film. What do you think the estimated budget, the brackets estimated budget was for the first film, given that you said it's not a blockbuster in the way that Bond is, and it's not a really expensive one?
No, I mean, it is...
In 1996.
It's obviously...
Just that you made the distinction, it wasn't, it didn't spend the same amount of money, but go on.
No, I didn't. I didn't mean to say that. I meant like it's not a kind of...
Yeah.
It doesn't have the trappings of a Bond movie.
Yeah. It spends the money, but it doesn't have the same... It doesn't look as expensive. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Like, so it's easily $100 million.
It's not. It's $80 million.
Okay.
But it is 1996, so, you know, these days...
Inflation.
That's absolutely...
Inflation.
Oh, man, that's a huge amount of money these days. Wow. Get out of here, how much money that is, you know? opening weekend US and Canada. What do you think? May the 26th. It's a spring movie. 1996. The world... 9/11 hasn't happened yet. The world is excited to get out to the theatre. They believe in truth and the future. They think the future's over, really. You know, they think it's the best it's ever been. How much money do you think this kind of movie makes with that sort of audience?
I mean, I think history's over. The end of history, my friend.
Sure.
I don't know. I can't... We've not done a film as old as this, so I have no frame of reference for how much they made. 40 million?
Yeah, very, very good. $45 million it took in its opening weekend. It's a lot of money. And then... it's gross worldwide. The multiplier is not dissimilar, to be honest, to what it would be in a modern era. So,
yeah, I don't know what the multiplier is, but it's going to do boffo box office and make 400 million.
457, baby. It's a 10x multiplier. Yeah.
Right.
GG. Okay. That was good. Well done. Let's see if you can keep it up on MI3 or Philip... three more Hoffman, yeah?
It's going to be more, isn't it?
It is going to be more.
It's going to be 110 million.
No, nowhere near, mate. One fiddy mil. Now, opening weekend US and Canada, tell me more. May the 7th, 2006. These films all come out in May. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, some are blockbusters.
Yeah, well, May's the spring, but, you know.
Always got to get the last word in. It's going to make... 60.
No, 47. Not much of an improvement.
Ooh,
really.
Interesting.
Yeah, not really an improvement. And then gross worldwide.
I think maybe only 350.
Well, a little more than that. 400, 398. So just under the more of a 9 X multiplier there. But interesting that it cost more, made less. You know, not much. I mean, it's a huge success. Well done to the film.
Well, you know, we're living in a post 9/11 world and people lost the vim and vigor that they had, the belief in cinema.
I think that's true.
As a cure-all. And they say, do you know what? I want to watch an Adam Curtis documentary on my laptop. I don't want to go and see lies on the silver screen.
I think
Thank
so.
You very much.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I think we're all thinking that. Now, Dead Reckoning Part 1. This is the movie that came out in 2023, if I'm not mistaken. That's correct, yes. And, of course, you know what month it was released in, don't you?
No.
It was July. I was trying to get you to say May. Anyway, what do you think the brackets estimated budget is for this movie?
I feel like I would have seen it. I feel like it's 180.
It's 291.
Oh, shit.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot, a lot of money.
That's a lot, a lot of money. That's because of strikes and COVID. But that's too much money.
That's how much money.
They're saying is part two is going to cost. That's why it's been considered. That's why it's been considered a failure, because you can't spend that amount of money on a film. You're not going to make it back. That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, God knows how much they spent on the marketing.
Well, they would have spent at least 150.
Then we'll find out if the film made money or not. Opening weekend US and Canada, July. A real summer blockbuster, this one. What do you think? How much money is this film taking? Of course, it is a post 9/11 world, but we're much further away from 9/11.
Well, we're a post-COVID world.
Post-COVID world, indeed. Did people get back out there? Did it get bums on seats?
It didn't, I don't think. Not quite, not, well, not enough to, as it should have. So I think maybe around the same, 50 mil?
Yeah, it was 55 mil, pretty close, inside the 10%. I mean, you're doing very well on these, I have to say. Very impressive. I mean,
hey, man, these are my movies.
Yeah, you seem to sort of know. Now, gross worldwide, I'll remind you that the budget was 290, we'll call that 300. You said 150 for the marketing, that's what you said, min, right? So it has to make over $450 million to make any money. What do you think this movie took gross worldwide?
I don't think it made enough, like 490?
It did 570.
Okay.
That's some money. That's a lot of money.
It's not enough for the whole... These need to, you know, you want to be making double, triple the budget.
Mission Impossible is kind of like my Harry Potter, isn't it? Your Harry Potter.
Yeah, go for it. Let's say that.
I think that's sort of what it's like. You were 15 years old. You saw the first one. It really struck a chord with you. You have a sentimental attachment to them, which helps your enjoyment of the films when you're watching them, and it makes you feel something, yeah? Whereas if I watch them and I think, well, these are serviceable action films, and in many cases, the action work is terrific, and they're tricksy and whatever, but they're basically, mostly, they wouldn't make me feel anything. We had a conversation pretty recently on this podcast about expectations, and I went into these films not expecting to feel anything, and I didn't. And in that sense, I feel as though I can evaluate them fairly for what they are probably supposed to be, which is entertaining flicks, you know?
Yeah, I don't think they make me feel anything. They engage me when they're really working. I think they are and should be like great examples of the genre. And when they're shit, like Two, Two is a bad film. It's also a shocking example of the genre.
So what's going on for you then when you say Mission, you don't think they make you feel anything, but Mission Impossible clearly makes you feel something because, you seek to defend it vociferously.
But what, the first one or the whole series?
Oh, the whole series. You know, like you don't like the idea that people might think they're shit. You think they're misunderstood. You're angry at a perceived audience of people who would consider them beneath the top crust of cinema. You would be angry and annoyed at someone who would say that they aren't art and that they're basically just shit, soulless action films. You wouldn't like that if someone said that. But you don't feel anything about them. I don't know. I don't think that's true.
No, because whoever's saying that,
whoever
it is, they haven't seen them. Like to say they're soulless, I just think is not engaging with them in a fair way. They've all obviously already written them off. There's a lot of soul in there. There's a lot of love and a lot of care and craft that has gone into making them. They are popcorn entertainments, but they've done very well. And there's a lot of smart writing, a lot of smart storytelling, good character work, fun scenes. I think it's hard to make those kinds of films. And there's, very rare that they work. They're generally shit. They look cheap. And, they go straight to Netflix. There's a lot of these look massive, they look great, and they're like the rare spectacle of a given year if they come out.
I think those sentiments are probably true. I guess what I'm getting at is that you afford these films the kind of additional consideration and a little bit of extra breathing room that you just don't for most other films. So that, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is why that is, you know, that you've said things about these films today that I think would be you defended these films in ways that I think you would criticize. You would say what I've been saying and criticize other films. So I'm just curious about what it is about these films specifically that makes you forego your normal, sort of cold as ice critical analysis and your normal kind of lack of kindness when it comes to extending any sort of alleviation for anyone, any filmmaker.
That's just not true. I'm not cold as ice. If a film, if it engages me and it's fun, if a film delivers on what it's supposed to do, says it is, this is the film I am.
Yeah.
And then it is the film it says it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And does it well. That is all I ever ask.
Like Lord of the Rings. Like Lord of the Rings.
I don't want that film. Right. because tonally I was just checking
because I think
there's a better way to do the Lord of the Rings films,
right? Yeah.
Like that isn't so, like, here's a way to do the Lord of the Rings films. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Hire any other actors to play the hobbits,
right?
That's like just number one.
And so
you've got
wrong.
You've got better films.
That's so wrong. Off the make bat, it a, it's just wrong. I mean, honestly, it's like you couldn't be further from correct. You know, listen, we weren't supposed to get here anyway. The end of this episode of Mission Impossible, you were telling me how to make the Lord of the Rings films better. The thing I'm trying to get at is for you to admit, just admit it, right, that you love these films. And that you might be a little bit leaner and more, like you might give them a bit more credit than you would give another film. Just say it. Everyone heard it already in the episode.
Well, maybe they can email about it. I love the first one and I love the third one. Uh-huh. I really like and enjoyed a lot Rogue Nation and Fallout. Mm-hmm. And Ghost Protocol is pretty solid, and the back end of Dead Reckoning, I had an absolute riot with that in the cinema. And when I rewatched it, I was still just thought the sluggish first half I had huge problems with.
Yeah.
And I would never say to anyone, "Oh, you should watch Dead Reckoning." I'd never recommend that.
You'd never reckoning in that, yeah.
I'd never reckoning it. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm, I will always fly the flag for Mission 1 and Mission 3 as top, tip-top examples of the genre. And I don't see that. Like, the third, like, I'm always going to go and see them because I saw the first one almost 30 years ago.
You see every film anyway, and most of the films you see are shit. So I wouldn't use that as a kind of, you know, I don't think that you'll always go and see them means that you have to love them.
Okay, let me add to that. I'll always go and see them with a degree of excitement and an open heart. Like,
yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And yeah, I'll be a bit more forgiving of...
Sure.
In my mind, I'm like... I still like kind of want to be more forgiving about Dead Reckoning. Like, well, okay, it's a bit like, oh, you know, and that scene doesn't really quite work, and it's a little bit, and the villain is a bit, but you know, come on, there's still this and this and this.
You sound like me. That's all I'm saying is you sound like me. Okay, and would you say I've been quite fair, haven't I, and kind and polite about your favourite films?
No, you were really horrible at one point.
Which point? When was that?
About when something you were sort of saying about Dead Reckoning. You were really, really vicious.
What? The bit about the villain?
No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
Generally, yeah.
Have I got space for one, just what, before we end? Just one more dig.
Dig away.
Yeah. Here's what I think. Because you keep talking about one and three, yeah? And I think three, oh... Philip Seymour Hoffman. Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's terrific, and I really enjoyed that film. One, I think it's so boring and rubbish. And when I watched that, I was like, how the fuck are we going to record this podcast? They get better over time for me. Two, obviously notwithstanding, they get better over time. Because one, maybe it's just like it's from 1996, and I just don't vibe with that time. but it's just so crap for me. For me, my experience of viewing it was crap. It was crap. And yeah. I like the more recent ones more.
I think there's, because there's a lot going on in the plot, you know, there's a lot of shenanigans.
I didn't even understand it. It's not clear what's happening at all.
And that's why you didn't like it.
It's for the more attuned viewer.
That's why, yeah, I find it compelling. I like that kind of more tricksy spy plot about, like, what's going on, who's double-crossing who, and it's all, you know, it's all nice and... It's my vibe.
Yeah.
That kind of flick.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, you Memento. Don't get it. You don't...
It's Memento.
Not really. It's not really Memento. It's just, it's like an American version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Sure.
But like in a lot bigger, sort of slightly dumbed down kind of way.
You can get me on that, by the way. I saw it once. I thought it was good, but I can't remember anything about it.
Oh, great. It's a great flick.
Should we tell the listener about what the next episode is going to be?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's wrap this up. Let's wrap this up. So we are going to do... It's been a while since we've read out correspondence, and we've got some correspondence. Mm. Would you believe it? So we're gonna go through that. Joe reads it out to me and I respond. That's how we do correspondence. And then we are gonna kick back into normal programming with LA Confidential.
Oh, that's the episode after next episode.
I've already rewatched it. Joe's been a busy boy. So Lord knows when we're gonna get around to chatting about it.
Sure.
And
Lord, you don't believe me.
Have you watched it yet?
All by myself. I'm just thinking you're Moby, yeah?
Have you watched LA Confidential yet?
No.